Hello and welcome back to the God Story Podcast. I'm Brent Siddle and I'm joined once again by Dr. Alistair Roberts of the Theopolis Institute in the States for another look at the Book of Revelation. And this time we're up to chapter 21, nearly at the end of what has been a mighty journey. Alistair, welcome back to the show.
It's great to be back.
Oh, it's always a pleasure to have you. Now, let's try and deal, if we can, with this a mighty chapter, the very end of the Bible, almost. What's the vision that John sees here in Revelation 21?
The vision is a two-part vision of the New Jerusalem and the new heavens and the new earth. And so we have an initial presentation in verses 1 to 8, followed by another presentation in the verses that follow. And this is the climactic vision of the book. It brings together many of the themes that we've had introduced from the very beginning, and think about various elements, for instance, of the promises that are made in chapter 2 and 3 in the letters to the churches. Can think about the reference to the tree of life in the paradise of God, the new name written on the stone, the writing on him, the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, the New Jerusalem, which comes down from my God out of heaven, and my own new name. And then there are other references in those chapters, which suggests that this vision really binds together a lot of the book. And also it binds together the whole of Scripture. It brings us back to initial images from the first few chapters of the Bible in Genesis. So this is an Edenic image. It's an image that recalls the temple in various ways, which of course is built upon the pattern of Eden in various respects. And so reading this carefully, I think, will give a number of integrating understandings for the rest of the Bible. Not just this part.
Yes, I think you've already partly answered this, but how are the new heaven and new earth a combination of Isaiah and Ezekiel?
We already noted in the preceding discussion that the book of Ezekiel provides a sort of template for the final chapters of Revelation. So there's the resurrection in chapter 37. The dead bones are raised up in the valley as the spirit is prophesied to. And then in chapters 38 and 39, you have the attack of Gog and Magog. And then in chapters 40 to 48, the building of this new temple, and then the water flowing out in chapter 47. You have the gates of the city, you have the measurements that are given, and all these elements are things that are picked up by John in Revelation. We've seen in chapter 20, the first resurrection, which corresponds to the spirit and being prophesied to and raising the dead bones in chapter 37 of Ezekiel. We've had the assault from Gog and Magog, corresponding with chapters 38 and 39. And now this section corresponds with chapters 40 to 48, the Ezekiel temple and the water that flows out will correspond with the chapter that follows in chapter 22. Also, the reference to the new heavens and the new earth takes us back to Isaiah chapter 65, I think it is, and that concluding section of the book. For behold, I create new heavens and a new earth, and the former things shall not be remembered or come into mind, but be glad and rejoice forever in that which I create. For behold, I create Jerusalem to be a joy and her people to be a gladness. I will rejoice in Jerusalem and be glad in my people. No more shall be heard in it the sound of weeping and the cry of distress. No more shall there be in it an infant who lives but a few days, or an old man who does not fill out his days. For the young man shall die 100 years old, and the sinner, 100 years old, shall be accursed. They shall build houses and inhabit them. They shall plant vineyards and eat their fruit. They shall not build and another inhabit. They shall not plant and another eat. For that like the days of a tree shall the days of my people be, and my chosen shall long enjoy the work of their hands. They shall not labor in vain or bear children for calamity, but they shall be the offspring of the blessed of the Lord, and their descendants with them. Before they call, I will answer. while they are yet speaking, I will hear, the wolf and the lamb will graze together, the lion shall eat straw like the ox, and dust shall be the serpent's food, it shall not hurt or destroy in all my holy mountain. This provides an important part of the intertextual background for the vision that we have in chapter 21. It's worth noting that the vision of Isaiah is not a vision referring to some time after the final resurrection. There's reference, for instance, to people dying in this section, even the righteous dying. And so this is not the final new heavens and the new earth. And more generally, when we're reading Isaiah and when we're reading even Revelation, we need to recognize the presence of different horizons, that the events that are anticipated on the final horizon have earlier iterations that do not express the full measure of what's hoped for, but are reality-filled promises of what is finally awaited. And likewise, in Isaiah's vision, as in other visions in Isaiah, there is this final vision of a new heavens and a new earth that has earlier expressions in the restoration after exile, for instance.
Yes, well, let's come and look at some of the details. There's a lot here. It's such a glorious and beautiful passage. Now, in what way will God tabernacle among men?
John chapter 1 is a very important framing of the entire gospel account. You have the prologue in chapter 1, verses 1 to 18. And part of that is the word becoming flesh and tabernacling among the people of God. We can think of that as part of the wider theme in John, where Christ is the temple. He talks about his body as that which will be destroyed in 3 days and raised up, but speaks about his body as the temple. Elsewhere, we see the pierced side of Christ corresponding with the water that comes forth from the temple. Now, as we think about that imagery, I think John's using something very similar in the book of Revelation. The tabernacling is, first of all, Christ tabernacling among us, but then it's also the formation of a new body. It's the body of the church, Christ's body, as this wider reality. We are being built into a living temple that is founded ultimately upon Christ, and it's an outworking of the fact that his body is the temple. We are his body and an extension of his personal body in the more immediate sense. And this vision is a vision that is not of a temple or a tabernacle proper. There is a difference, because the temple or tabernacle proper were primarily antechambers that were waiting for access into the throne room. Most of the activity was taking place outside of the Holy of Holies, the place that represented the throne of the Lord. And now, when the Lord dwells properly with his people, there is no longer any need for a temple, because there is direct access. And this, I think, can be seen more clearly in the imagery of the chapter of this chapter.
Yes. Yes, I was going to ask you how the New Jerusalem is described here. I mean, we've got gemstones and gates and the number 12. Looks like today's number 12.
We've seen the number 12 occur at several points in the connection with the 12 tribes of Israel, the 12,000 chosen from each tribe. We've had the 12 apostles, we've had the 24 elders as 2 times 12. And here I think this is an important number for the structure of the city. The city is has a shape that is 4 square, and its length and width and height are 12,000 stadia. Think about the way that the 144,000 was formed of 12 lots of 12,000. And this is 12,000 times 12,000 times 12,000. The city is a cube. Now, the cube number we've already commented upon, 10 by 10 by 10 as 1,000. And this is a cube city formed of numbers that contain cubes as well, because it's 12,000. Now, if we think about a cube, it should draw our mind back to the great cube, which is the Holy of Holies, the holy place, the most holy place. The most holy place in the tabernacle and the Holy of Holies within the temple are both cubes in shape. Now, the fact that this new city is a cube in shape, very strange shape for a city when you think about it. It's not, it hasn't got dimensions of 1 by 3, which you would have if you had the larger temple or tabernacle, where you have the antechamber of the holy place before the most holy place or the Holy of Holies. The fact that it's just a cube highlights the fact that the Lord's presence is enjoyed directly. And people are coming into the Lord's presence. There's no longer this chamber that is outside of it. And this is the throne room itself. And so the shape itself gives a sense of the meaning of this city. This is not a regular temple. This is corresponding not to the temple, but to the most holy place within the tabernacle and the Holy of Holies within the temple.
Yes. Now, what's the significance of the gemstones and jasper? Jasper's particularly mentioned there, isn't it? But other gemstones?
Yes, we've got gemstones in other visions. For instance, if you go back to Ezekiel, there are gemstones mentioned in connection with the vision of chapter 1. You can think also of the gemstones that are mentioned in chapter 28 in the Garden of God. Think also of the gemstones that are connected with the garments of the high priest in Exodus chapter 28. All of these are, I think, background for what we have here. This is a more glorious form of that, where what was formerly just part of a garment has now become the whole city. Now, we can also think about the way that there are pearls on the gate, the treasure of the land that was brought in to temple or the tabernacle is now extended to include the treasures of the sea. Think about the parables of our Lord, where he'll talk on the one hand about a harvest within the land, and then on the other hand about the emptying out of a dragnet, an image of a sea harvest. Or he'll talk about the treasure hidden in the field, and then talk about the pearl of great price. There's a land image and then there's a sea image. And what we have here is a city that has sea and land treasures. Think back to Genesis chapter 2 and the description of the Garden of Eden, which is really the most fundamental background for what we have here. The Garden of Eden was surrounded by lands like the land of Havilah, where the gold was good, and bdellium and onyx stone to be found there. This is the glorious form of the garden, where the treasures from the surrounding lands have been brought in to dress it. It's the mature form of the city. And so I think this is what helps to bind the Old Testament, the very beginning of the Old Testament, to the very end of the new. This is a new Adam and Eve in the garden. It's a new garden scene, but now it's a glorified garden city. It has the tree of life. It has the waters of life flowing out as the river flowed out of Eden. And it has other such elements. But now it's a city in which the great antagonist, the great adversary, has been defeated and destroyed. Satan's been cast down. Yeah. And so there's been a transformation of the order. We've returned to the beginning, but now it's a beginning that has been glorified.
Yes, I was going to ask you whether the 12 gemstones refer to the signs of the zodiac. I note that John's list is the reverse order of the signs of the zodiac.
Possibly, yeah. The other thing is the more immediate association through which that association could be drawn would be to the tribes of Israel, that the tribes have these gemstones connected to them in the high priest garment. Mm-hmm. And then the fact, for instance, that the city is particularly associated with jasper might connote Judah, as Judah being connected with jasper in particular. And the 12 jewels also connect with the 12 apostles. So you have these associations, the high priest breastplate, the 12 apostles, the 12 tribes, etc.
Yes. How does the city reflect the arrangement of Israel's camp in the wilderness?
In Numbers, chapter 2 particularly, Israel is arranged around the tabernacle. The tabernacle is like the sun in the center, and the constellations of Israel's tribes are oriented around it. And it is stipulated which tribe should be in which position. And so you have Judah as the tribe that leads them out, for instance, facing towards the east. And then in Ezekiel, in chapter 48, you also have the orientation of the tribes around the gates of the city. So here, some have suggested that we need to read those things alongside each other to see some divine ordering of the tribes around the city, perhaps according to the order that we find in the choice of the 144,000 in chapter 7. So if you read the order of the tribes there, Judah, Reuben, Gad, Asher, Naphtali, Manasseh, Simeon, Levi, Issachar, Zebulun, Joseph, and Benjamin. It's not a straightforward order, but it may correspond to the stranger order of on the east, on the north, on the south, on the west. And so it's not going out around clockwise or counterclockwise. There's a slightly different ordering. And so if you try and map those on, compare them with Ezekiel, compare them with Numbers, some have suggested David Chilton has done some work on this in Days of Vengeance, and then Peter Lighthart as well in his commentary. Those are the connections to explore.
Yes, fascinating they are too. Now, come on and deal with the Song of Songs. In what sense is Jerusalem the bride from the Song of Songs? How does this chapter bring together all the imagery from the Song of Songs?
Yes, at the beginning of the Book of Revelation, you have a great vision of the bridegroom, a sort of wasif, a description from head to toe or toe to head that describes all the different varied glories of the figure who's presented as the beloved. Now, the Book of Song of Songs is filled with such visions. Now, also, as we've gone through the Book of Revelation, we've noted at various points the allusions to the Book of Song of Songs. And in these concluding chapters, I think this becomes more pronounced. And I think also there's a connection with the Book of John, where we also find such allusions. Jesus, for instance, is connected to the king in chapter 1, verse 10 of the Song of Songs. While the king was on his couch, my nard gave forth its fragrance. And this is Christ being anointed by Mary of Bethany and the nard scent filling the house. Or we can think about Jesus buried in a garden tomb, out of which the rivers of the water of life flow forth, and the spiced garden tomb is going to be opened up, and awake, O north wind, awake, O south wind, and blow forth the wind, this scented breeze. It's the promise of the Spirit flowing out from the opened grave of Christ, the open garden chamber from which the beloved goes forth. Think also of the way that Mary Magdalene seeks the Lord, can't find him anywhere, finally finds him in the garden and tries to hold on to him. This is the story of Song of Songs. Now, there's been quite a bit of work done on some of this background. You can think about the bridegroom Messiah imagery. Jocelyn McWhirter has done some very helpful stuff on this. The best stuff to read is Warren Gage's his PhD thesis, in which he discusses this in great depth and argues that the Book of Revelation can be mapped onto the Book of John, and that they are all exploring this great nuptial theme. And at the very end, we've had the wedding feast, and now we've got the bride being revealed. The revelation of the bride is this glorious scene that, again, we might see some similarities with the beginning of the Gospel of John. The descent of the Spirit, for instance. Now we have the descent of the bride. There is great correspondence also between the bride and the city. This imagery of the city as a woman is, of course, something that is common in Isaiah and elsewhere, where Zion is the bride, or Zion, daughter Zion, is presented as a female figure. And here, the figure is of the church, the Jerusalem above, that in Galatians chapter 4 is described as the mother of us all. This is the mother city, descending like a bride. It's going to be brought into this eschatological marriage. And the whole book of Revelation, going with the Gospel of John, is an exploration of marital or nuptial themes.
Yes, I was going to ask you in about 2 minutes, what does the book of Revelation teach us about sex and about marriage?
Yes, quite a lot. I think what it teaches us is the archetypal reality behind it all. Now, many people see the ultimate prophecy of the gospel, the primary prophecy of the gospel, being in Genesis 3:15, the seed of the woman and the seed of the serpent and the enmity between them and the promise that the seed of the woman will crush the serpent's head. Now, before that, there is another text that Paul connects to Christ and the church. A man will leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. That, ultimately, Paul says, is in its fullest sense about Christ and the church, not about, it's about marriage between a man and a woman, but ultimately behind it, there is this greater archetypal reality, which is the union of Christ and his people in the Spirit. Now, that is what we find in Revelation chapters 21 and 22. It's the conclusion of the vision. This is Adam and Eve, the new, or the last Adam and the new Eve. Eve is an image that's used of the church by Paul, where he talks about the church as betrothed like a virgin to Christ. And he's concerned lest by his wiles Satan would deceive the church as he deceived Eve. The church is a new Eve to be married, to betrothed to the last Adam. And the great vision at the end is of this marriage. Now, this provides a backbone for John and Revelation. And I think it provides backbone for the whole of the scriptures, which moves from the garden scene and the man and the woman, Adam and Eve, to this garden city scene and the new Adam, the last Adam, and the final Eve.
Now, in what sense, Alistair, is this a city of light? And in what sense is this a vision of theosis?
In the Gospel of John and at the very beginning of Revelation, Jesus is presented as the light of the world. He's presented as the light that was coming into the world. In the beginning of John, he's seen in a dazzling vision of light. He's surrounded by light as well. He's surrounded by the lampstands. And this is also accompanied by the seven spirits that are like fire. All of this is a glorious vision of light. Now, when Christ comes to the city, this is, again, something that he's illuminating. He is the sun. He is the sun of righteousness that has arisen with healing in his wings, according to Malachi. He's the one who comes as the sun coming forth like the bridegroom in the Psalms. This description is, again, the bridegroom coming forth from his tent or tabernacle, the sun. Christ is that true sun. He's the one who stands in the midst of his people. He's the son of righteousness. He's the one who has brought with him the new day, the eschatological day. And so this coming of the eschatological day fittingly comes with the coming of the true light. Arise, shine, for your light has come. Let Christ shine upon you. All of these things correspond with the situation that we now exist in, which is the situation of the day. Now that the eschatological light has dawned, we have to act as people of the day, no longer engaging in the activities of the night as those who are of the night. We are those who carry with ourselves something of that light. We reflect that light, and that's part of the image of theosis, that Christ transforms his people. When we see him, we will be like him, as we are those who see the glory of the risen Christ. We reflect something of that glory. As Moses' face shone So we reflect the glory of Christ in lives transformed, in lives that reflect his glory in the transformation of the spirit, the moral transformation, and the way in which a society formed by such transformation is itself not just individual lights, but a city set on a hill and a light that is not to be put under a bushel. We are like lights in the heavens. The church is salt and light, in the same way as Abraham's descendants would be like the sand on the seashore, like the salt. They are also to be like the stars in the heavens, like the lights that rule with the sun and the moon over the day and the night. And so there is this reflection of Christ's glory in the life of the church, and there is a manifestation of his light within our lives. This is a common theme within the epistles. The church is, you are the light of the world. Christ is the light of the world, from whom we get that light. The imagery of light as that which is born by us. The Spirit has lit us as lampstands. The church is the lampstand. The church is the light. And then all of this is connected with the eschatological light that has dawned and now will dwell among us in our midst, bringing that light so that it will never be an alternation between day and night. There has been this glorious expected day that has dawned at the very end of Revelation. Now, this hasn't yet occurred. We're still waiting for this full realization. We've experienced the first resurrection as the martyrs have been raised up to God's throne. We have not yet experienced the second resurrection, nor have we yet experienced the full reality of Christ's light. But yet we have an initial experience of this. We already have seen the initial light of Christ that has been brought about by the resurrection. And so we reflect some of that light here and now in dark days, but as those who are shining forth with the light of the expected day that has dawned in Christ and will reach its full zenith in the new heavens and the new earth.
Yes, I think we've probably already answered this question. Last question, in any case, what's the picture of the church that John presents us with here? What can we learn as a church from this vision?
Several things. I mean, first of all, we learn the character of the church as a realm of fellowship with God, a realm of fellowship with God like the most holy place. Think about the way that the most holy place contained the gold items. This is a city of gold. In the same way, the tabernacle was defined by gold, silver, bronze, the first day items corresponding with the most holy place in particular, and then the holy place had gold items in it too. But as you went out, it was silver for the stands of the tabernacle structure, and that was used, the census money was used to construct that. And then in the courtyard, there was bronze. This is a city of gold. This is also a city that is defined by the 12 of Israel and the 12 of the apostles. It's a city that is defined by these two realities, by Israel and also by the church that is formed upon the foundation of the apostles and prophets. Jesus Christ is the chief cornerstone, as we see in Ephesians chapter 2. That description with the foundations of the apostles and prophets might also allude to the fact that these are martyrs. They laid down their lives, and in laying down their lives are the foundations. In the same way as you can walk through a grand cathedral and see upon the floor memorials and tombstones of people that have died, that are the foundation, that are built into the foundations of that building now. And this is, I think, part of the meaning. We can think also of the way in which this is a city that is cube-like. It represents the most holy place. We have access into God's full presence. We're not held at a distance. There's no veils here. This is a removal of the veil that once divided. And so whereas formerly there was the veil of the firmament, now heaven and earth have been brought together. There is also this vision of the glories that have been taken in. This is a consummated creation where no longer is there this division between the land of the upstream land of the garden and its trees and the downstream lands with their treasures that have not yet been. This is a consummated, glorified earth. This is an earth that shows the maturity of man's labors. These are things that have to be brought in. This is also a building. It's not just a garden. It's a construction, and it represents people. We are a living house. We are being built together as a single entity. This is not a vision of individual Christians. This is a vision of a body that has been formed together. And so all of those are some of the initial things that we can get from it, but there's a lot more besides that.
Yes, an understatement. Dr. Alistair Roberts, thank you very much. Dealing with Revelation chapter 1, a magnificent chapter. Lots in there, Alistair. Thank you so much. And thanks to our creative team at Liquid Edge, who sponsor this podcast and who take care of things behind the scenes. Alistair, one more to go. See you next time.
We really hope you've enjoyed this episode of the God Story Podcast. If you want to help us make more great episodes like this one, you can head over to our Patreon page and become a God Story Podcast supporter. You'll receive our undying gratitude, plus a few bonus goodies for your ongoing support. Just visit patreon.com/godstorypodcast. That's patreon.com/godstorypodcast. As always, you can get in touch with us via our website, godstorypodcast.com.